This is Nick Ditkovsky from Dr. Nerve and Vomit Fist, and you are listening to House of Noise.
What?
What do you mean, go ahead?
You like to say our intro.
You don't want to see it?
I don't want to take it away from you.
Welcome to House of Noise.
Maybe I should have. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Oh, my gosh.
So, this episode, we had a great time talking to Nick. I don't want to butcher his last name, so I'm not going to say it. Ditkovsky.
Yes. Ditkovsky.
Ditkovsky.
Yes.
I think it's Russian. I was going to ask him, too.
Yeah.
That's another.
Well, it might be Polish because it's ski.
Yeah, I was wondering that, too. It might be Polish, but it might be Russian. Yeah. I don't know.
We'll have to have him on for part two. Yes. Very, very interesting guy.
I'm not lying. There was a ton of stuff I didn't even get around
to. Well, we'll just have him back on again. That's all. We'll do a part two.
Yeah. Round two.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah, we talked. We talked about a lot. What did we talk about? We talked about Dr.
Nerve.
Dr. Nerve. Mm-hmm. We talked about his
single. If you were me right now, I'd be dead.
His video, which is
and the video, yes,
very interesting video.
Oh my gosh!
We talked about his son and the band that they're in together, Vomit Fist.
Yes, and the war paint. How his son came into like metal because sometimes kids don't follow in their dad's footsteps all the time. We talked about his degree in computer music and how he came up with the JMSL program.
And he teaches at NYC, I believe, at the university. So he's a teacher, too. He's an instructor.
Well, there's the short version. You want to hear the long version?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of great stories in there. We hope everybody really enjoys this episode.
Yeah.
Very
educational. It was very learned a lot. So it was interesting, certainly.
I wanted to add that for whatever reason, I hit record and the first 3 minutes didn't record. So if it comes in a kind of a weird spot, it's going to come in at a weird spot. So that's why it's coming in a weird spot. I just want to add that before we get off here. So enjoy this interview with Nick. Bye.
Bye.
It's going to be a string quartet. And that was like the joke that everyone laughed at. And then Wendy, my wife, chimes in. She says, well, actually, my husband just wrote a string quartet. And everyone's just like, where is he? Can we call him? And long story short, within 24 hours, we were at the studio shooting my string quartet on camera, the cops coming in and interrupting the conductor. And I got like 9 seconds of my music on Law and Order Special Victims Unit. I made more money in those 9 seconds that I spent recording like the hour of the piece itself that we made in the studio. So, geez. As many seconds of video or film or movie, you want to put my music on, I am so game for that.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. I have to say, you have been in the industry for a long, since like 1983 approximately.
84. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And when you look back at your beginnings, have you kind of progressed? Do you still work your music the same way, or do you do things a little differently? Or
oh, that's a great question. Well, I think the common thread from the beginning has always been I've really been interested in rhythm, like heavy grooves, and I was really interested what was going on in New York in like the early 80s, late 70s. There was like a club scene where there was really aggressive groove-based music with experimentation. on top of it. There was sort of a hardcore experimental improvisers community going on. And then there were like these heavy groove bands. And there were people that were putting these things together. For me, like the big insight was like, I can do the weirdest, you know, rhythm, heavy groove that I can come up with. As long as it repeats, people are going to dig it, you know, and then I can put experimental stuff on top of that or weave it in throughout it. And it became this kind of sort of template for exploration that I adopted really early on. And I think that's sort of been consistent throughout my musical life. I like to address, you know, body rhythm, like get you feel it in your body, but also, you know, explore stuff that addresses your like higher, you know, more ecstatic states of mind, maybe, or you know, certain intellectual ideas or structural ideas or whatever, but keeping it grounded in like heavy rhythm, heavy body stuff.
Yeah, I noticed that you don't do a lot of vocals either. You just let the instruments kind of do the singing for them or for it.
Beautifully put, man. I think about the way music was when I was in high school, right? We were in a band, and this was the typical experience. It's like you put a band together, you got a good drummer, good bassist, got a keyboard player, you got a rhythm guitarist, you got lead guitarist. Everyone's like playing at the top of the game, and it sucks because of the vocals. No one can sing. You know, it's like, what are the bands that we love? You know, back then, Deep Purple, Queen, Alice Cooper. It's like, good luck, you know, Rainbow. Good luck trying to find someone to sing like Ronnie James Dio, you know. You might find someone that plays like Ritchie Blackmore, but you're not going to find anyone that sings like Ian Gillan, you know.
So needle in a haystack.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And let's say you do find someone like that. Good luck hanging on to that person, you know.
Right, yeah.
So,
well, it's not even just...
So you're sort of...
Yeah, it's not even just a good voice. It's the fact that they have to fit what you're playing as well, too. I mean, you could have somebody with a killer voice, but if they don't fit what you're playing, it's not going to work either. It's tough finding
absolutely.
A singer.
Yeah, the personality, it just like cuts through. So I felt pretty liberated. Like after my high school experience, I went to college and I was kind of brokenhearted. Just like I can't play in my high school band anymore, you know. But that was a cover band, and there was not going to be any future in that.
Right.
And anyway, so, and I remember just getting into a whole wider range of stuff. A lot of it was instrumental music and or long instrumental passages where like everything that the music has to say is being said, you know, sonically. And so by the time I started to put a band together after college, I just happened to be in a community of people where there were horn players and it's like, hey, that's like, those are my vocals. You know, the horns are doing all the melody that I would want to do with a vocalist. And I don't have to think of words.
Right.
And they get to improvise and they can function melodically. They can function rhythmically. They can do solos. There's no like archetypal sort of front person sucking up the attention from the rest of the band. Everyone's equal. You know, there's no front man or front woman in a band of eight, you know, instrumentalists. And that's not saying anything against, you know, most of the music that I love has singers, you know, in it. Right. Mm-hmm. But for the music that I wanted to make, it was tremendously liberating to work in instrumental music. And that's kind of been a signature for a while.
Yeah, I love the fact, and this just blows my mind, one, that you slowed down the speed of the video. You can't even, I couldn't tell when I watched it at all.
Yeah.
And then you guys learn the music backwards.
Well, something does seem off when you're watching it. You just can't put your finger on it while you're watching it.
But it's not, it's not really all that noticeable.
Right.
Most people wouldn't even notice.
Right. Well, that's the kind of cool thing. It's like, it's on that fence, right? It's on that weird kind of edgy fence where it's like, what, you know, is this just like 5 frames per second or is like something else going on? You know, it was an idea that I had for a while. And I always wanted to try it. And what I really liked about it was that in that it was truly it, like, it's a truly experimental idea in the sense that I don't know how this is going to turn out.
Right.
You know, it may just be a lot of work for nothing, you know, yeah. or it might actually look kind of cool, or maybe sort of on that fence where if you look closely, you realize, like, you know, there's definitely something weird going on. Like the hair shouldn't do that, you know, or like piece of paper should not fall up off the floor onto the music stand.
Yeah,
you know, that doesn't usually happen. So I really was looking forward to testing this out. So we filmed this. You're talking about the Dr. Nerve video.
Yes,
if you were
yes.
me right now, I'd be dead. And
yes.
we filmed a lot of it forwards, half speed. Mm. And then kudos to my drummer, man, Leo Siesa. He actually learned it backwards.
Oh, okay.
Which is just so freaking insane. He
yeah.
played backwards half speed. So we did a bunch of him backwards half speed. I learned my guitar solo half speed backwards. The keyboardist, Kathy, and Jesse, the bassist, and I, we learned some of our riffs backwards. And then, you know, filmed them like that and then flipped it and sped it up and synced it to the audio. And I was really, really happy with the way it turned out. And, you know, I appreciate what you're saying. It's like something you can't quite tell what it is.
Yeah.
It may sort of be indistinguishable. But on the other hand, you kind of look at it and go, like, you know, there's definitely something.
Yeah.
something going on here.
Yeah. I bet you guys had fun, though, because it looked like you guys were having a really good time.
Oh, it was great. It was great. It was great. And we got the shiny mudflap girls into the video, which is one of our favorite things to do. Kathy Sapovi has these two shiny mudflap girls that we named Bambi and Ricky. And, you know, they're the Touch of Class, you know, profiles. Mm, so like, mm-hmm. I don't even know who that artist is. Like, who came up with that? It's like you see as many of those as you see the Keep on Truckin', you know, logo. It's like one of those piece of cultural art that is just out in the wild. Anyway, so we had a composer friend named Art Jarvinen who would collect these things, these shiny mudflap girls. And I inherited two of them from him. And of course I gave them to Kathy because she's totally into this kind of really kitschy, like softcore porn stuff. And so she always brings them to Dr. Nerve gigs and sets them up on her keyboard.
Nice.
So of course she like displayed them proudly at the end of this video. So there's Bambi and Ricky are shining in the spotlight at the end. And we're really happy they made that appearance.
Oh, that's cool. That is super cool.
So you formed Dr. Nerve back in 84-ish, right?
Yeah.
Are all the members still the same members, or have you gone through different players to come in and play with you?
We've gone through a couple of them. So probably the oldest member is Yves Dubois, soprano sax player, and Michael Lytle, the bass clarinet player.
Oh, okay.
But the very, very earliest version of the band was a band called Spy Boy. And we only existed for like a couple of gigs. And then by the time we actually called it Dr. Nerve, Yves was already in the band and Michael was already in the band, but we had a different lineup. We went through a number of players, but they tend to stay for a long time. You know, like the new guy in the band is Ben Harrington, and he's been in the band for like 10 years.
Oh. Right?
So, all right. So there's some staying power, you know?
Yeah. So I'm guessing they all share your vision of, you know, thinking outside the box and doing something different with the metal genre and trying to, you know, make something new.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like this. It's a really rich relationship now that involves, you know, years of friendship and experiences together and a shared, you know, vision and seeing that vision evolve over time. But one thing I've always really wanted to do with my music is write to the players, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'll give someone a solo in a piece that I'll go just like, oh man, that's perfect for Lytle. You know, that is perfect for what Michael does with his bass clarinet. He's going to get a solo in this piece. And then like, you know, Rob, our trumpet player, he's going to get a solo in this spot. It's going to be, you know, perfect for him in this passage. So I feel like the personalities of the players are really baked into the pieces. So I think, you know, as a player, to feel like you're more than just, you know, no one's a sideman. You know, I never thought of anyone as like being support in Dr. Nerve. Everyone's a featured player. When we play out, you know, I say the names of everyone on stage, you know, multiple times. It's like, sort of like Zappa did. You know, everyone that was into Zappa knew who Ruth Underwood was, right? Everyone knew who everyone in his band was because their personalities were so strong. And that's the case of Dr. Nerve. You know, everyone's got a really strong personality. And I leveraged that so that they, you know, everyone sort of comes to the forefront at one point or numerous points during the show. So there's that kind of shared ownership of the music.
That's very nice. And I would think that
more bands should do that.
Yeah. I would think that kind of camaraderie and, you know, it translates into appreciating the uniqueness of each member and what they bring to the table. And I would think with that kind of thing, that there's not as much room for a clashing of egos
Proof is in the pudding. I mean, your youngest member that's, you know, hasn't been in the band that long is 10 years. So, I mean, right there, it shows that, it works.
Yeah, we all, you know, we can be apart for a long, long time. And then when we get back together, it's just amazing. It's like no time has passed. We had such a good time just being in the same room shooting this video the other day. And, not the other day, the other month, but you know, it's just like everyone just picks up with the same, you know, entrenched, awful humor. Like we got this, you know, this is just jargon and like years of dumb jokes that just circulate through and pepper our language and, you know, oblique references to something that happened on tour, you know, 15 years ago that still makes everyone laugh today. It's just awesome. The having, you know, a long musical relationship in your life is just precious. It's incredible. There's nothing like it, you know, and that's not to say anything against new projects either. You know, like my band Vomit Fist, we've only been around for a couple of years, but, you know, and that's a very different sort of project.
Oh yeah.
Very, you know, spazzy, intense metal trio. And, you know, we don't go back 30 years, you know, I mean, my son is in the band. He's only, early 20s. So it can't be that old a band, but there's just, you know, long relationships are just precious. It's just, there's really nothing like it. Dr. Nerve is a gift, man. It's, I feel like I'm sort of bearing witness to it as well as organizing it. You know, I feel so lucky that it's in my life, that it never broke up. It never stopped. It may go on pause for a while, but then we put something new out and the excitement is just as palpable now as it was 30 years ago.
That is very, very nice.
You know, Vomit Fist, how did that come to be? Did your son come to you and say, "Dad, I want to do something"? Or like, what
happened? That's exactly how it came to be. That is exactly how it came. I remember the moment it happened. I was taking him to like an appointment somewhere, and we were walking on the sidewalk, and he said, "I want to put a black metal band together with you. I think that would be cool." I'm like, "Okay, that sounds really good." And by then, he was a freaking killer drummer. You know, he was. A killer drummer and is a killer drummer. And so it was not like, isn't that cute? We're going to go on a fishing trip. It's like, Leo's a good freaking drummer. So the idea of playing with him was like, yeah, man, let's do it. So, so we did our first show as a duo, and then he kind of designed the band. He said, you know, what would be really great would be Malcolm singing in this band would be awesome. So he asked his friend Malcolm, and Malcolm said yes. And then he came up with the idea of doing this sort of tribal paint, war paint, corpse paint kind of thing. And we went with that. And, you know, that's how Vomit Fist was born. You know, the name, Leo came up with the name during math class, wrote it in his notebook, like all of us have done during study hall and math class. You know, you doodle in your book, and he came up with Vomit Fist, and thus was born Vomit Fist.
Oh, that's so nice.
He obviously grew up in a musical household, but, you know, a lot of kids, sometimes they'll go the opposite direction of whatever their parents are into. So, you know, was that like a natural thing that he kind of just started getting into metal, or, you know, was that take some time?
Yeah, he had really his own trajectory. I mean, he started playing drums in, I guess, maybe third grade or fourth grade.
Really?
And his teacher, his teacher was Leo Ciesa, the drummer in Dr. Nerve. Oh, so okay. He would come over every week, and he would just show him wild, you know, every week was something really different. They would work on composition, or they would work on improvisation or jazz or polyrhythms, or, you know, he would bring over like this whacked out, totally extreme range of stuff for Leo to work on. And my, you know, our hands were, it was like a hands-off thing as far as the parents were concerned. This was like his thing.
Okay.
He was going to study it and like take it as far as he wanted. And then he got into this program called Thor, run by a guy named Tomato Harfenist. He had this, it was like a rock school kind of thing, you know, where kids would get together and put bands together. And so he was in the metal program because that was really the music that was nearest and dearest to Leo's heart.
Okay.
And that's like he really blossomed there. He's always really been sort of more attracted to metal than any other single genre. But it was really him, you know. He's like making his own decisions and following his own heart. I tell you, one of the most developmentally successful, you know, you might even call it like a failure of an experiment, was sending him when he went to an arts and performance high school.
Okay.
Which was actually a great experience. But he studied in the percussion program there.
All right.
And learned right away that's like, man, I do not want to be part of the percussion section in an orchestra. I mean, he played great. You know, I'm kind of joking when it's a failed experiment. There was nothing failing about it.
Right.
But he just learned through that experience that it's like, no way, no freaking way. I'm not going to be in an orchestra. You know, I'm a metal drummer. I belong behind a drum set. I want to play the music that I love. If I play a lifetime of music that someone else wrote that I don't believe in, it's going to freaking kill me. And he learned that at the, you know, at the tender age of being in high school. And some people never learn that, or they, yes, or they spend money going to a conservatory and discover after 2 years or 3 years or 4 years that it's like, oh my God, I thought I was going to have fun playing music, but this sucks. Right. You know? So, he just carved out his own life. He's very, very strong-willed, very individually minded, and he plays the music. He's never played a note that he doesn't believe in.
That's awesome.
You know, speaking of how, you know, he's finding his own way and how he's deciding what he wants to do, is I want to kind of get into, how did you decide that computer music was what you wanted to get into? I mean, you obviously could have went down the whole route of, I'm just going to play in a band and, you know, do that. But you took it to a different level than that, you know, you don't normally see metal musicians go to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would sort of rediscover that I was excited about computer programming. Like it would kind of go to sleep for a few years. And then I would, by chance, I would be introduced to it again, you know, and then I would really get into it. It's like, wow, this is fun. You know, I can sort of come up with an idea and make a machine do something and sit back and watch this little robot do something that I programmed. It's like, it's a really, really simple, beautiful kind of relationship of like just coming up with an idea and seeing a machine do it. You know, it's like just as a pure, like it feels like magic or something.
Okay.
So every so often I would just kind of rediscover how much I would enjoy just the simple act of programming as a creative and intellectual challenge. And there was a moment where, what the heck was it? I would have to say it was, my dad sent me an article that he clipped out of Scientific American. Mm. And it was about knot theory or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but social scientists. And it's like the prisoner's dilemma is like this basic idea of how do you make decisions that benefits society as a whole when you don't have the full picture of what's going on, right? This profound sort of look at how people interact in society. It was a mathematical model that had really strong consequences when applied to the way people behave in groups.
Oh.
The word prisoner's dilemma comes from this notion that, like, imagine you and your partner in crime were both being interrogated independently, right?
Mm. Right.
So you're both given the exact same deal. It's like, if you think on your partner, then we'll give you a better deal and your partner will go to jail for longer.
Yeah.
If you keep your mouth shut, you're both going to get some amount of jail time, right? So the best situation is if both people keep their mouth shut, right?
Right.
The worst situation for the other guy is if he keeps his mouth shut thinking you're going to, but you fink on him because you want to get a better deal, right?
Yeah. Right.
So, and there's no communication between the two. So it's this really profound sort of moral dilemma, right? It's like the Cold War, you know? Mm. You've got two nuclear armed nations, the USSR and the United States, right? If you both just trust each other not to launch, you'll both be fine, right? If one guy launches and the other guy trusted, then boom, you know, hey, I won, you know? It's like whatever that means, you know, it's a horrible idea, but like in total brute force terms, right? Mm-hmm. One would sort of win. And so you have to trust that people make rational decisions without being able to communicate with each other.
Yes.
So I thought, wouldn't that be an amazing thing to apply to music? And I figured, well, the only way to do that would be through some kind of a computer music system where you're on a network and people make decisions that are, you know, blind to each other, but there's some kind of a sonic realization that kind of illustrates whether they are cooperating or whether they're competing.
Oh, okay.
So long story short, I mean, that's, you know, the details are immaterial, but basic idea is that I was excited about modeling this prisoner's dilemma game theory in some kind of a musical performance. And I needed a computer to do that. So I got myself a computer and I studied this language called HMSL and started to get into writing software that made sound, that expressed musical ideas. And along the way, it occurred to me, it's like, well, I might get to this prisoner's dilemma idea at some point, but I got this band, Dr. Nerve. Wouldn't it be really cool if I wrote some software that would generate ideas for Dr. Nerve? So I started to do these little programs and slightly bigger programs and built this kind of idiot savant kind of software where every time I would run it, it would generate a piece of music that sort of sounded like my band. And it blew my mind. It was so freaking cool. It was like, you know, my favorite part of getting a gift, I got to say it, you know, like on Christmas, you get a gift. What's the coolest part? It's the part when you're just opening it, right? Mm-hmm. The gift is wrapped up.
Anticipation.
And it's the anticipation, right? So that's sort of what this software is like. I write the software and then I can't wait to hear what it's going to do. So that moment of like hitting go is that moment of unwrapping the gift. And I have no idea what it's going to do. So you hear, you know, 20 seconds of music or 30 seconds of music or a minute of music that comes out of the computer. And some of it doesn't sound particularly exciting, but sometimes it's just like, whoa, I never would have thought of that in my in my life, you know? So you save that. And then I develop that into a piece. So it's like having this kind of weird agent in the room that is just really good at generating tons of ideas really quick. And I can just thumbs up or thumbs down them as they come out. And it feeds this whole process in a really sort of hyper-stimulated way. It's pretty trippy.
That sounds really neat, actually.
So how did it come about that you created the JMSL program then?
Yeah, it's everything I was just describing that was developed on the Commodore Amiga,
right?
Which I don't know what percent of your listeners are going to remember the Commodore Amiga, but it was a really revolutionary computer,
right?
Put it that way. It was just the coolest hobbyist kind of computer. And I was using that computer and I was using this language called HMSL, which was developed at the Mills College Center for Contemporary Music.
Right.
It's pretty obscure. And the Amiga was always kind of like this marginalized computer, you know. Apple was coming out with the Apple IIe and Atari was coming out at the time. And then the first Mac started to emerge and the Amiga sort of became more and more marginalized. And after using it for about, I don't know, maybe 10 years or something like that, I finally had to accept that I was working with an extinct you know, I was working with an extinct species. There was like no future in this machine at all. And it became kind of free. It kind of froze me a little bit. It's like, how much do I really want to start a new piece on this machine? You know, as soon as this thing dies, it's like, I'm done. This is
True.
You know, hard drive breaks, like something goes wrong on this computer, I'm screwed, you know?
Yeah.
So right around the same time, the Java programming language hit my radar, and the power of Java was that it was supposed to run on multiple platforms. Mm. So it didn't care. It could run on a Mac, it could run under Linux, it could run under Windows. So that was really attractive to me. I saw my real hardware, my favorite hardware, you know, go the way of the dinosaur. I wasn't going to be locked into hardware anymore. So along comes this language that doesn't care what it runs on. It's like, yeah, sign me up. That's great.
Yeah.
So so I started to learn Java, and I started to port some of the ideas from HMSL into Java, and it was a successful experiment. I just started to build up JMSL as sort of the Java version or the successor of HMSL rewritten in Java, and I've been using it ever since. I teach it at NYU. I got students that have been using it for years now, and got a small community of users all over the world that that use JMSL, and it's just my go-to music environment.
So if, for people that don't know what JMSL is, how would you explain it to them about how a musician would use it?
Basically, as a musician, you wouldn't use it unless you really wanted to write a program to realize a musical idea that you couldn't realize with like a standard sequencer. Okay. Like so here's what it, here's who wouldn't want to use it. If you're really comfortable, like opening up Logic and like entering notes into it, you know, into the drum track and recording music into it and building up your pieces like that. Those are really powerful tools, and your problem is solved. You know, that's definitely how you should continue to work, and that's fine. But if you had this like whacked out idea, it's like, what if I, you know, looked at the last 10 years of sunspot activity and translated electromagnetic behavior, you know, taken over 10 years or, you know, tidal information and converted that into rhythms and music and melody. Oh, like, okay. How would I do that?
Gotcha.
Then there you go, man. Write a program. You know, you're going to be writing in a general purpose programming language like Java. You can query the database. You can decide how you want to convert those numbers into rhythm or into melody or whatever. And JMSL is your toolbox. You know, it's going to make hard things easy. It doesn't make easy things easy. And other tools make easy things easy, but it makes hard things doable. That's really the power of JMSL. So come up with this whacked out idea. You know, I had this one student who had a theory about this really simple, beautiful idea that her niece was learning how to touch type, right? Mm. Okay. So she's typing, and there's really no way for her to know if she's making a mistake if you're touch typing, because specifically you're not supposed to look at the keyboard, right? That's right. The whole point of touch typing. So she had this theory. It's like, what if we assigned pitches to the keys of the keyboard?
Oh, that makes
so
sense.
As you're typing, you hear little melodies, and over time you would sort of start to hear what English-like melodies are, and you would sort of start to learn what kind of melodies are mistakes, right?
Okay.
So like a simple example, if you know, you always hit the letter U after you hit the letter Q, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So that would be like a da-da, maybe. And if you hear like da-dun, that would be unusual. And gotcha. You wouldn't know that at the beginning, but over time, you would sort of start to learn that certain kind of melodies are, I'm typing properly, and certain type of melodies would be like, oh, that was a mistake.
Right.
So she used JMSL to do that. You know, what else is she going to use to do that kind of idea? So the more out there the idea, the more appropriate JMSL is for people to use. So it's a wide user base, and no one has anything in common with anybody. That's what's so cool about it.
Well, you had mentioned the electromagnetic from the planet. I actually just read an article like probably a week ago about what sound do our planets or different planets make, and even the sun. And because they set off different electromagnetic pulses and stuff, they actually created sound from those. So I wonder if they actually, they must have used your system there.
Well, they could have used that, or they could have used something more more direct, you know, like just taking the numbers and then writing them to like a WAV file and playing it back, you know. So I, you know, mine is not the only computer music platform out there, but it's good contender for giving people that are interested in algorithmic music a general purpose programming language like Java with a whole suite of musical tools that just sort of solve the problem of like, okay, here's the math, here's the process, here's the data. Let's hear it. Let's put it up on a staff. Let's see what it looks like. Let's hear what it sounds like.
Cool.
Wow. That is like super cool. It kind of reminds me back in the day of the game Simon, where you heard the different pitches and you had to repeat the same pattern. And if you didn't, you got the messed up kind of sound. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. That was a fun game. But so I want to get back to Loud, the album, the EP that if you were me right now, I'd be dead. And the album art, does the artist live here in the United States? And how did you get together and how did he kind of create the art for Loud?
Yeah, that's Masato Okano. And he lives here in the New York area. And I met him through this music festival called the Death Metal Punk Fest. And right. Metal Punk Death Fest that was happening at St. Vitus. And Masato was part of that scene, and he was doing like live mural drawing during the festival. He would draw these amazing like monsters on the wall while bands were playing. Cool. And he's strongly associated with like a metal sort of punk hardcore scene. And I was just like, wow, this guy, this is amazing. I love the way he put his visual compositions together, and so much energy, and really like high, there's a sense of humor in it, and it's sort of like this sort of like playful horror, and this sort of punk aesthetic and a metal aesthetic, and he's really like carved out his own thing. So when we put this record out, I'd actually approached him to do a Vomit Fist record, and then I forgot which one I asked him about first, but I think it might have been Dr. Nerve. I don't remember. But I figured, man, he would be perfect. He's just like, you know, the record's going to be called Loud. Like, I want something really explosive. Oh, yeah. And this guy's going to be perfect. I didn't want anything, you know, I didn't want a photo. I didn't want anything sort of too abstract. I wanted something that was just like a punch in the face, you know, and Masato was perfect for that. So I contacted him and he was totally stoked about it. I sent him like a SoundCloud of the rough mixes. He loved it. He was really, really into it. So he would listen to it and do his drawings. And he's a super intuitive guy. Like I saw like an early, you know, he sent me like an early sketch as it was developing. And he had the two guitar necks in the middle. He had those like monsters playing the guitar because he heard it as very guitar driven music. And I loved it. But I sort of went like, oh, man, I got seven other people in the band. You know, this is going to look a little indulgent, you know. So like I just kind of broached the topic. It's like, dude, could you maybe like put other musicians in there too? You know, but he was totally into it. You know, at one point he's like, okay, but I don't want this to be like homework. You know, I want to do the art that I want to do. And I was like, yeah, of course, do it exactly what you want to do. But if you can like, if you could just work it in somehow, put in some like crazy looking horns or like keys or whatever. And he was totally into it. And you saw what he came up with. It was mind blowing. He's one of my favorite people in this planet, man. Masato is just amazing. He did a whole mural for this metal bar in Queens called Lucky 13.
Oh, nice.
If they ever open up. I mean, when they open up again, I'm looking forward to getting down there and seeing what that looks like. Super cool dude. He draws, you know, he does jackets for people and decorates guitars for people. He's just super open-minded, really cool guy.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love artists. I love art.
Me too.
I can't help it.
Yeah.
I wish we could talk longer. You're a super interesting guy. We love that you came on here and talked to us. We had a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm so glad you invited me. Thank you very much.
Definitely.
We love that you listened to some of our past podcasts too.
Yeah, I really appreciated your your high praise. So,
oh, I really enjoyed it. I'm honored that you had me on. I mean, you're like talking to some heavy hitters there, and the stories I heard were like these, you know, like really heavy, like deep life stories about guys, you know, recovering from addiction and like, holy shit, you know, like, yeah. What do these guys want from me? You know, and so it's like, I'm going to talk about computer music. Like, okay. You know, I trust your judgment. So I just dove in. It's like, all right, I love the tone of your interviews. So it's like, I'm going to be super comfortable talking to these people.
Well, thank you.
And I'm just really happy that you reached out. I appreciate it very much.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Maria, she has been in the business for a while, and I've learned so much and just been exposed to so many other artists because we've had the honor of being able to interview artists from Adrenaline PR. So it's, you know, it's been a blessing. Yeah. And
oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Is she the best or what? Oh,
she
my
is,
God.
She is.
She's outrageous. She's outrageous. I feel so lucky to work with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where is the best place for people to go if they want to find out more about Dr. Nerve? And I know you got merchandise too.
Well, Dr. Nerve has a good Facebook page. So if you just search for Dr. Nerve, spelling out D-O-C-T-O-R, Nerve, you'll find us on Facebook, or just go to drnerve.com, spelled out again, D-O-C-T-O-R-N-E-R-V-E.com. And links to Facebook and Twitter and our Bandcamp is all there.
All right.
Or, you know, drnerve.bandcamp.com. There's not too many Dr. Nerves out there. Right. So if you just type it in, you'll find us pretty quick. Every so often I get a question from someone who's suffering from something. I feel so bad. It's like, sorry, man, we're a band. Yeah, right. I hope you feel better. You know?
That's awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Nick. You have been, this has been a good time, and I've really learned a lot, and I wish you guys the best of luck during this pandemic.
We're going to get you back.
Yeah,
on.
We will. We will for sure.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. So hopefully next time we'll be, everyone will be healthier and more optimistic, but it's a real ray of light to be talking to you guys during this time. Thanks a lot.
We definitely appreciate you.
All right.
All right, take it easy and enjoy the rest of your sunny, beautiful day in New York.
Definitely.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.